from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Boston, 1967. A 20-year-old woman named Catherine Switzer decided she would run in the Boston Marathon. There was nothing in the rules specifically prohibiting women from running. They never really did. She registered for that race using her first and middle initial and picked up her bib and number on race day just like everyone else. 2 miles into the race, the director of the Boston Marathon was alerted that a woman was running as a registered competitor. He waited for her to pass his spot on the route, then ran onto the course and tried to grab Catherine and physically remove her bib and number. But Catherine's boyfriend realized what was going on. He threw a body block and the race director was sent flying. Press photographers captured the moment, which has become iconic in the women's equality movement. And maybe you've seen it. I've posted it on our Twitter account. You can see it today. Switzer finished that race. And then 5 years later, the same man who tried to push her off the course became an ally and helped ensure that women would be welcome at the Boston Marathon. Catherine Switzer is a member of the National Women's Hall of Fame in Seneca Falls. We're going to talk with her later this hour. We're going to talk with another past inductee, Lily Ledbetter, the woman whose name was on the legislation signed by President Obama regarding equal pay for women in 2009. Lily Ledbetter coming up at about 1:15. And the 2015 inductions are coming up as well. We're going to find out who's on the list, how the list gets made, how the committee makes some of the choices. Let me welcome my guests in studio. Judy Pfeiffer is here. She's not only a co-chair of the 2015 inductions, but a member of the Women's Hall of Fame herself, inducted in 2007, thanks to her reputation as being the mother of infrared astronomy. It's my honor to have you here, Judy.
And it's my pleasure to be here, Evan.
The mother of infrared astronomy is a great title, and also the first person from the U of R inducted. Is that right?
That's right.
That is exciting for us in the local community. So it's great to have Judy, and Diana Smith is here as well. She is not only involved with the proceedings here, she's a member of the MRB group now in Rochester, and she's the former mayor of Seneca Falls. In fact, the last mayor of Seneca Falls, right?
The last ever.
Yeah. and that just happened how long ago now?
Concluded in 2011, December 31st of 2011.
The village rolled into the town, is that right?
It did.
Okay,
yes.
So, and what was sort of surprising to me is with the history of Seneca Falls in the equality movement, you were the only female mayor of Seneca Falls?
Ever elected.
Doesn't
That's
that
true.
Seem incongruous with history?
It does, with the birthplace of women's rights, yes.
Yes. Well, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. Before we get to Lily Ledbetter at 1:15, Barbara Igluski at 1:30, from the University of Rochester as well, and Catherine Switzer at 1:45. Let's just talk a little bit about the significance of choosing women to go into the Women's Hall of Fame. And Judy, as a member yourself, and as someone who sees the process up close now, how does this process unfold on an annual basis? What happens?
Well, it starts February of the year prior to induction. And at that stage, we evaluate nominations that we've received from the public. The members of the hall, the board members, they cannot play a role. It has to be a nomination from outside. I mean, I could nominate somebody, but I don't get to choose. I don't get to know anything about that. And we set up a nomination process whereby the 150 nominees were placed into categories. And then we found experts throughout the country to act as the referees of the nominations. And once all the grades come in, we look them over without knowing who provided any of the information. And we work to make sure that the grades are reasonable in the following sense. Some people grade between 0 and 5, some people between 5 and 10. So what we do is we regularize each referee's or judge's scores so that they have a common mean or common average and apply a correction factor to the grades. And then once that's done, the grades are rank ordered, and at that point, the board enters in to evaluate where we are.
Okay. Diana, the process to you, it's I don't say complex, but it's there's a lot that goes into it. It's a very thoughtful and important process. How important is the process to you to get these nominations right for lack of a better description?
Oh, my goodness. Having actually served as
an evaluator, it is incredibly difficult. You mentioned earlier two inductees. There are hundreds of stories, and each one is just amazingly significant in terms of our American history, in terms of our growth. To score these is really a difficult thing to do as an individual.
Yeah, the Lilly Ledbetters of the world are probably the easy ones, you know, the ones that you say, boy, it would be a shame not to have someone like Lilly Ledbetter, who we'll be talking to in just a second. But how many total people, how many women are in the Women's Hall of Fame, been inducted?
256 to date. It's a every other year process.
Okay.
And began 2 years after the hall was founded in 1969.
And how many this year?
10.
And is that typical?
9 to 11 is the typical number, yes.
Okay. Can you give me a brief sense for...
Who they are?
Yeah, for who they are and what they've done.
Okay. Tenley Albright. She was an award-winning skater in the mid-50s. Then she returned to medical school and became an acclaimed surgeon. She now continues to work to further women in surgical careers. Nancy Brinker made a promise to her dying sister, Susan B. Komen, that she would organize the Susan B. Komen for the Cure, and she's raised a substantial amount of money for cancer research. Martha Graham, the iconic dancer who has been likened to the Picasso of dance because of the unusual art form that she engendered. Marcia Greenberger, she is the founder of the National Women's Law Center, and she has been involved, her law center has been involved in every major piece of legislation affecting women's rights. Barbara Iglewski, who you'll be talking to, she is a microbiologist, and she has done some seminal work on how bacteria interact with the cells in the body, and I'll let her describe her work rather than me. Jean Kilburn, she is an image maker. She worries about the image of women in advertising. She wrote a documentary called Killing Us Softly, and she has tried very hard to improve the image of women in advertising. Carlotta Wells Lanier, the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, at age 14 or 15, she was one of the people who occupied the Little Rock High School in Arkansas, and as you may recall, the National Guard had to overcome what Governor Faubus was doing. Philippa Merrick, she is a leading researcher on the investigation of T cells. She was a postdoc at the University of Rochester, actually, at one stage. Mary Harriman Rumsey, sister of the governor, and also the founder of the Junior League. Eleanor Schmiel, founder of the Feminist Majority, and a very active woman in the role of women's rights. And that comprises the 10 for this year.
Well, there's a ceremony coming up. Can you give us before we jump in with Lilly Ledbetter, who's going to be talking to us in just a minute,
right?
Which is an exciting moment for our audience and for the host of this program.
Right.
What's coming up with the ceremony? What do you want the public to know?
Well, the ceremony itself is on Saturday, October the 3rd. There are a limited number of tickets still available. And if people wish to purchase one to come to either just the ceremony or the luncheon and the ceremony, they should contact the hall, Pat Allness, P-A-L-N-E-S, at womenofthehall.org, or call 315-568-8060.
Got to do the number again. Go ahead.
315-568-8060.
And that's two Saturdays from now for the induction ceremonies. Let me bring in my next guest, a previous inductee in the National Women's Hall of Fame. Lilly Ledbetter became a central figure in the fight for equal pay for women, and her name is on the legislation that passed in 2009. She's on the line with us now. Lilly, thank you so much for your time. Welcome to Connections.
Thank you. What an honor to be part of this program.
Did you ever think when you were in the middle of your work career that here you would be decades later, an inductee of the National Women's Hall of Fame?
No, sir, I did not. I had no ambitions to have a case in the Supreme Court or to lobby in the White House in Congress and then go to the White House and have a law named for me. That had never entered my mind.
Well, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act passed in 2009. And just to refresh the listeners' memory, Lilly, can you give us kind of the brief capsule of your career and what sparked that concern about equal pay?
Yes, sir. I had had a really good career for a middle-class American citizen and female at that during the time. But I hired in with Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in 1979 as a manager in their production area of the radio division in Gadsden, Alabama, which was a great opportunity for a woman. And I worked there for 19 years. And then someone gave me a note telling me how much less my pay was than the white men doing the same job, not similar job, the same job. And my first thought was how hard it had been to make ends meet in my household and to send my two children to college and keep all the bills paid. And my overtime had been so shorted because of the lack of pay. And also, it also goes on into my life today that what I was earning for those 19 years and 10 months affects my Goodyear retirement. It affects my contributory retirement, my 401k, and my Social Security. And I went as far as I could take my case. And when I made that decision, it was about me and my family. But when the verdict came out in the Supreme Court, in May of 2007, it was no longer about me. It was about all of the American families, what I could do to help them and to change this grave injustice back. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her dissent, she challenged Congress. She said, the ball is in your court to change this grave injustice back. And that's exactly, Congress took up the fight, and I went to the Congress, to the House and the Senate, and I lobbied and worked extremely hard to get this bill passed.
Just to give our listeners a sense for the actual pay discrepancy, you know, Lilly Ledbetter did not go throughout her career thinking that her pay and her career was going to be heavily scrutinized in the media, but here we are, and you're paid around, I've read, about $3,700 per month. The lowest paid male was getting paid $4,200, more than $500 more per month, and the highest paid $5,200. So we're talking, you know, even the lowest paid male was nowhere near what you were getting paid.
And, no, sir.
And,
no, sir.
And so let me just ask you a few questions then about the current state of pay equity and where we go next here. First of all, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act of 2009, is it doing what you had hoped when this was in process, when your name was going to be on it?
Yes, sir. It basically put the law back to where it had been, but made it much clearer for people to interpret. And the previous cases, like the Ledbetter case, had always been interpreted based for the plaintiff, because that was the interpretation. But the new Supreme Court justices did not choose to interpret it the same way as it had been done. So it was important to put this law back. And so many people across this nation has told me, I went in and asked about my pay. Was I making what my counterparts were? And in a few days, they'd hand me a huge check, because they knew that if I did not get satisfaction, I would take them to court. And that's what it allows people to do. And that is not what women want to do. They just want the right to have the job and to fulfill their family's needs and plan for retirement.
Lilly, did you ever think throughout your career as a manager that the discrepancy in what you were making was that much different than what the males were making?
No, sir, I did not, because I worked for a major corporation that had massive government contracts. In fact, most of their work was government contracts for the Army and the military and military planes. But what I had learned, I thought, sure, they would to get those contracts, they would have to answer certain documentation and adhere to all federal laws and guidelines. But to my horror, I found out that no one was forcing them to do that. As of a couple of years ago, President Obama signed into law a new bill that if you get government contracts, you will furnish documentation and you will answer to the government and you will adhere to federal laws and guidelines. Had that been enforced during my working time, I would have received the rightful pay that I should have gotten. And where I worked was like a lot of other places today. It was a major secret what your salaries was. And my attorney and I learned in discovery that a lot of years I was paid below the minimum for the job I had.
We're talking to Lilly Ledbetter, whose name is on legislation, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act in 2009. And she has not only been an inductee of the National Women's Hall of Fame in Seneca Falls, but become such an important figure in the fight for pay equity. Now, Lilly, when we look at sort of the landscape today, we often hear 77 cents on the dollar. I think it's important to point out a couple of things. Number one, the 77 cents on the dollar indicates generally what women make compared to men for all jobs. In other words, men are making more money than women for paid work. When you look at the same job, it's closer, but it is not parity. Men are still paid more than women for doing the same job. And it's not 77 cents on the dollar. I don't know where it is, but it's certainly not parity. And we've had conversations on this program, Lilly, about the complex factors that go into that. For example, women are more likely to be penalized either overtly or covertly for pushing for a raise. Men are sort of expected to push for raises. Women, and again, generally speaking, push less for raises, less for promotions. And there are people who've called this program, Lilly, and they've said, well, if Lilly Ledbetter didn't stomp her foot and ask for more money, you can't blame her boss for not giving it to her. And I'm curious to know what you would say to that.
Oh, I did ask. I did, because I was approaching retirement, and I needed, and see, I knew that when I retired, my check would be based on what I was earning and the rest of my retirement income, and there would be no more raises in my life. I had to get my pay up, and when I asked about my pay, I could not get a straight answer. They'd say, oh, I don't know, but I'll check and let you know. Well, 2 weeks later, I hadn't heard. I'd ask again. I even sat down in my superior's office and said, I need to discuss my pay and where I'm at and what I can attain because I'm approaching retirement. He goes out the door. He gets up and leaves me sitting there. They did not want to talk to Lilly Ledbetter. So when I learned the desperate, in fact, there was one of those guys, the four of us that had the same job was making $5,900 per month, and his overtime pay would figure out to be about $40 to $60 an hour. And this is not right, because here's the other epidemic, why I'm so passionate about this today. Women are still held back. They're still not compensated, and it's always some reason that it's the woman's fault. But if you could take the applications, the work experience, without seeing the person and knowing who you're talking to, color, sex, or whatever, there would be more women in top positions than ever before. It's still a rare thing to have women promoted to top a Fortune 500 companies and to head up these major corporations. It should not be that way, because women are talented. They bring another expertise to the work, and the companies who are successful today are learning that they incorporate women and men together in management. They've got a more complete team. The other reason that I'm so passionate about this, I've learned that there are so many women across this nation that are in the same predicament I am. We are a widow, and we average outliving our spouses 10 years. And so many military families, so many American families, have to move their mothers in their home and take care of them because they do not have enough retirement because of lack of pay, the quality in their working years to stay independent in retirement. And that's an epidemic in this country. That's a hardship. And this country has the resources, education, and we're better than this.
That's such an important point. You think about taking care of your family. Yes, the average woman in a marriage outlives the man. And if you want to take care of the family long term, that's an important point that doesn't get brought up very often. Lily, before I let you go then, I just want to ask you your thoughts on some of the conversations about how to make sure we have equal pay for women for the same work. I there have been a couple of CEOs, and not many, but some who have said, we're changing our policy. We are setting the pay, and whoever we hire, male or female, that's the pay. There is not going to be negotiating coming in the door. Other people say, look, if you allow people to negotiate what they make coming in the door, you're always going to have some disparity. So the question is, can the government do anything else? Is there a specific proposal that would start to address that? You know, what do you want to see happen next?
What I want next is paycheck fairness. That's been voted on, and I understand in Washington that bill's been around about 15 years. Had that been on the books back in my working career at Goodyear, I would have known how much I was paid. I would have known because I pursued. I wanted to know how I stood, how I rated, and I could not understand the company I worked for not wanting us to have some competition between us to achieve greater things on our in our work. But paycheck fairness in Washington, the last two times it had passed the House, it needed to go to pass the Senate. It needed 60 votes to carry it forward. Every Democrat voted for them, but not one Republican. And one of the things that I am so honored and so proud of about the Ledbetter bill, it was sponsored, co-sponsored by Republicans and Democrats, and it was voted into law by both parties, because what I'm talking about, this has nothing to do with either party. This is everybody. This is every person across this nation. It's, and the men understand it. What I love about traveling and talking to groups now across this great nation is that men understand it. They get it because they got wives, they got daughters.
Lily Ledbetter has been my guest. She is an inductee, a past inductee of the National Women's Hall of Fame in Seneca Falls. Lily, some final thoughts from you about being a member of the Hall of Fame. And you know, I know you don't personally know every member of the current, the incoming class, but what would you say about just the experience and the value to you of being a part of this Hall of Fame?
It was one of the greatest honors that I have ever had in my life. Having my name on a bill was pretty big, but having my name on that in that Hall of Fame, coming from my background, means so much to me. My daughter and I was there in 2011 when I was inducted, and we were back in 2013, and we'll be back there this year. And two of the people, Marshall Greenberger, who you heard her name mentioned a while ago, and Ellie Smill from the Feminist Majority, there are two significant women who helped make my bill pass. I have traveled with both of those women, and the Marshall Greenberger and her law center backed me up, and they helped write me speeches. And when I testified twice in the House and twice in the Senate, and they traveled with me to the Democratic Convention in 08 for me to speak to the nation on my proposal and my what I want to see happen in this country, and I can't say enough for them. And every woman that's inducted has a tremendous story. I mean, and to go into Seneca Falls, New York, where it all began, this, it's really humbling.
Lily Ledbetter joining us. Thank you, Lily. We will see you at Seneca Falls then for the 2015 inductions on October 3rd, two Saturdays from now. And I know, like I said, decades ago, you never would have thought this was your lot in life and what you're doing, but I think a lot of people view you as working with grace and force, and it's our pleasure to have you on the program today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. It's my pleasure, as always, to speak up, and hopefully someone will hear your program today that they'll say, I've got to find out what I'm making it work.
Lilly Ledbetter joining
Thank
us.
Thank you, sir.
The name behind the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act of 2009. And before I take our brief break here and bring in our next guest, let me just ask our guests in studio to respond to what they just heard. We've got Judy Pfeiffer here and Diana Smith, and they are helping us get ready for the National Women's Hall of Fame inductions coming up two Saturdays from now. Diana, she's pretty remarkable.
She's amazing. And if you think about that, the magnitude of the impact of her story, one of the things that's always amazing to me about our ceremonies is that when people ask me, who's my favorite inductee, I might be able to answer that question going into the ceremony. I can never answer that question coming out. You hear stories that are of equal magnitude. I mean, just there are an incredible number of women and stories that if it weren't for the Hall of Fame, I would not have been exposed to them. And that's the importance of the mission of the National Women's Hall of Fame.
Judy?
I agree with that. It's always a very moving ceremony. I mean, I find myself listening to the stories of these women, whether they're known well in the sense that Lilly was or not. I find myself with tears in my eyes listening to what they have to say. Lilly is an amazing woman, and there are many amazing women, and their stories are phenomenal. It's well worth it. And it's well worth it to visit the National Women's Hall of Fame in Seneca Falls. We are hoping by 2016 to be moved into a new building, the former Seneca Knitting Mill. It's in a state of repair at this point, rehab. We are fundraising for the mill, but it's going to make a wonderful place where women's stories can be told.
Let me also go ahead and bring in a caller who's been waiting to join the program, and it's a different Barbara, not our next guest, but it's a Barbara in Penfield. I would remind our listeners today that the inductees are nominated by the public, and Barbara wants to weigh in from Penfield on her hero. Go ahead, Barbara.
Yeah, hi, Evan. I tell you, I've had October 3rd circled in red on my calendar ever since I saw the list of who was going to be inducted this year, because my all-time hero, Eleanor Snell, is going to be one of them. I am an Ellie Snell groupie ever since sometime in the 70s when I lived in Wisconsin, and I went to the Illinois Capitol, Springfield, and saw her way in the distance on the steps, urging the legislators to pass the ERA. And every chance I get to see her, hear her, I'm there. She is phenomenal, just like Lilly Ledbetter and all the other women. I'm just thrilled to be able to be in the audience for this. And I wanted to let your listeners know, I know everybody can't make it down to Seneca Falls on that Saturday. Well, we're very fortunate that Ellie has agreed to come to Rochester on Sunday, October 4th. And as part of NOW, I'm a member of the Rochester chapter of NOW. That's the National Organization for Women, which, of course, Ellie was president when the ERA tried to get the ERA passed. So she has agreed to come and talk and in co-sponsoring with the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum. It will be at that carriage, at the House's Carriage House at 2 p.m. on October 4th. Limited seating, so people do need to register. So go to the SusanBAnthonyHouse.org and look for upcoming events, and they can register there. And one more thing, in addition, we've just hit every jackpot we filled, because in addition to Ellie, the current president from NOW, Terry O'Neill, will be coming as well. So we're just in feminist heaven.
Barbara, thank you for the phone call and for sharing your thoughts and letting us know about that. And let's get a short break and let's come back and talk to a different Barbara. Barbara Glusky, who is one of the inductees in the 2015 class. We're talking about the National Women's Hall of Fame, and we'll talk to Barbara next. I'm Evan Dawson on The Next Connections. It's Innovation Friday. The fourth Friday of every month is Innovation Friday, and our colleagues at the Innovation Trail bring the content, the stories, the interviews. On this Friday, we'll have a conversation about tax reform and the American tax system, among many other topics. Hope you'll join us on Friday, Innovation Friday, on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Rochester Area Vegan Society, presenting the film Plant Pure Nation at the Rochester Academy of Medicine, Sunday, September 27th at 1 and 4 p.m. ASL provided at the 4 p.m. show. Visit rochesterveg.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined in studio by a couple of people who are helping so much with what's coming up in the National Women's Hall of Fame 2015 inductions, Judy Pfeiffer, who's also a past inductee herself in 2007, and Diana Smith, who also happens to be the former mayor of Seneca Falls. And we have Barbara Igluski on the line with us, who is a professor emeritus in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Rochester, and she is one of the 10 inductees in 2015. Barbara, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you so much for having me on your program.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us, and let me just ask Judy Pfeiffer, what's the biography you want to share with our listeners about Barbara Igluski and why she was chosen?
Well, Barbara was pivotal in working out the communication between bacteria and cells in the body, and has been actually helped to cure specific diseases. I think Barbara is a better person to ask that than me.
Well, Barbara, your own department at the University of Rochester says exactly what Judy's talking about there, that your lab was the first to discover that bacteria use a communication system, kind of a chemical language, to coordinate attacks on human cells and initiate disease. Can you, how did you figure that out? Tell us about what was happening.
So many things in science occur. It was somewhat serendipitous. We were really studying, trying to clone a gene for an enzyme that a particular bacteria makes. And when we cloned and sequenced the gene, it was not the gene we had been going after, but it was a gene that looked remarkably similar to a signal that bacteria use to talk to each other. And then we went on to explore what that gene was doing, and it was regulating whole sequences of genes in bacteria, a gram-negative bacteria, that causes hospital-acquired infections. And when you looked at what genes were turned on and what genes were turned off, it allowed the bacteria to cause different kinds of infections depending on the patient it was infecting. So depending on the underlying problem the patient had, these hospital-acquired infections, this particular group can cause different kinds of infections, from chronic lung infections to acute lung infections to disseminated burn infections. So it had to have an exquisite way of regulating that. And we tend to think of bacteria as being little single cells doing their own thing, but in fact, through this cell-cell communication system, they are able to coordinate gene expression in millions of bacteria simultaneously. And that allows them to really do much more than a single cell could do.
And so what's going to come out of this work that your lab was able to do and what you were able to understand about bacteria?
Yeah, well, a lot of people then got interested in this phenomenon, and it turns out many, many bacteria do this. And it causes many of them cause different kinds of infections, and not just human infections, but plant infections and a variety of other things. And commercially, these organisms can then coordinate behavior and cause what's called a biofilm, which clogs pipes, water pipes. It clogs all kinds of oil drilling rigs. So commercially, they've targeted particular chemicals to interrupt those signals. In terms of human infections, it's been a little more difficult because the signals the bacteria use mimic certain human signals. And so then you have to have a drug that is very specific and will attack the bacterial signal but not interfere with the human signal. That's proved to be quite challenging. But there are a number of laboratories currently working on that problem, and there are a number of drugs in various trials, preclinical trials mostly.
Barbara, was there a moment for you when you were working on this problem, and even if it was So as you say, serendipitous, this kind of discovery, this kind of work. But was there a moment where you sat back and said, you know, this could really change things? The understanding what's happening here, I mean, this is new and this could be revolutionary. Did that moment happen for you, or was it more gradual?
Well, I think when at first there was this feeling that, oh, foo, we did the wrong thing, you know. But then this is, and I think this is a key thing for science and many other things. Sometimes when you set out to do one thing, you end up discovering something else. And if you discard that discovery, you miss the boat in many cases. And so I looked at that data for a long time, and suddenly I realized, wow, this is so much more important than what we set out to do. And that was really a oh my moment. It was a terrific elation.
What a story. Well, before we let you go, I just want to get your sentiment, your feelings on being inducted as a member of the 2015 class to the National Women's Hall of Fame, the third member of the University of Rochester, and what it means to you.
Well, it's the greatest honor. As Lily Ledbetter said, it's the biggest honor I've ever had. It's overwhelming. It's intimidating. It's very humbling. You look over the people who are in the Hall of Fame, and many of them are my heroines, people that whose careers motivated me and motivated so many other women and have helped so many of us. So I just hope that I can continue to help other women.
Congratulations. Very, very well deserved, Barbara. And thank you for taking the time for our program today.
Thank you, sir.
Barbara Iglewski joining us. Judy Pfeiffer, your University of Rochester class is growing, and I imagine that makes you proud.
Yes, very, very proud. I was particularly interested in having Barbara appear on the program because it's of local interest as well as national. I mean, we are a national entity, the Hall, but since this is Rochester, I definitely wanted our Rochester candidate to
be
here.
Well, but in case anybody missed it earlier, no special treatment for Barbara Iglewski. They go through a very rigorous selection process. She
absolutely
was chosen not just because of her local connection, but because of the body of her work.
That's absolutely true. And it's a rank ordering of the grades that we have acquired on each of the 150 nominees to come up with a class of 10.
I want to move to our next guest, who is a woman who decided to run the Boston Marathon in 1967. Catherine Switzer was 20 years old. No woman had ever run as a registered competitor, but she saw nothing in the rules at the time to stop her. So she signed up, she picked up her bib, and she ran the race. Now, the director of the Boston Athletic Association would later say this about women running in the Boston Marathon. Quote, "Women can't run in the marathon because the rules forbid it. Unless we have rules, society will be in chaos. I don't make the rules, but I try to carry them out. We have no space in the marathon for any unauthorized person, even a man. And if that girl running were my daughter, I would spank her." End quote. Just imagine. Well, Switzer did run, but a couple of miles in, the race director was told that a woman was running in the marathon and went out and tried to physically remove her. What happened next is captured in iconic photographs, the director trying to grab Switzer and Switzer's boyfriend shoving the director off the road. She's a graduate, by the way, of Syracuse University. She's a past inductee of the Women's Hall of Fame, and let's talk now to Catherine Switzer. Catherine, welcome to Connections. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Great. It's wonderful to be back upstate New York.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people in our audience have probably seen the iconic photos of you in that marathon and, you know, this gentleman who's grabbing you, trying to pull you off the race, but they might not connect it exactly to the full story of who you are and what you did. How many people over the years have come up and said, boy, I saw that photo. What an amazing moment.
Evan, it's amazing. First of all, I wouldn't call him a gentleman for attacking me in the race and trying to throw me out.
Yeah, that's fair.
Although he became a gentleman later. Here's the story. And that photo now is in Time Life's book, 100 Photos That Changed the World, which just goes to show, you know, how times have changed and how sometimes the worst things in your life can become the best things in your life. And this is the story, is that while I was a student at Syracuse University, I was training with the men's track team. One of the unofficial coaches was an ex-marathoner, felt sorry for me, kind of took me under his wing, and he he was telling me stories about the Boston Marathon, which was the greatest day in his life. And when I told him I wanted to run it, he didn't believe any woman anywhere, anytime, could ever run a marathon, despite the fact that they had in the past. Not many, but a few. And he said that if I would train for this race and prove to him in practice that I could do the distance, he'd be the first person to take me. So we trained together mightily, and I did prove to him with a 31-mile run one day. He helped me sign up for the race. I signed the application with my initials, K.V. Switzer, because that's how I signed my name, and officials at the other end thought that, obviously, K.V. was a man. There was nothing anywhere written that this was a men's-only race, even in the rule book. It was assumed that a woman couldn't and wouldn't want to run anyway. So 2 miles into the race, there I am wearing my bib numbers, and the press truck goes by, and on the press truck is the race director, and he lost his temper and jumped off the truck, ran after me and grabbed me and tried to pull my numbers off and throw me out of the race. And this was all captured by the press truck. Of course, it had a funny and not funny at the time kind of ending, because my boyfriend, who was an ex-All-American football player, threw a crossbody block into this official and sent him out of the race instead. So this series of photos of girl running and girl being saved by boyfriend, and I went on to finish, of course, became iconic photos. And you know, you have to thank this old guy for attacking me, because those photos have become some of the most galvanizing photos in the women's rights movement, and certainly have helped propel the incredible revolution that's happened in women's running and in women's sports. There are now more women runners in the United States than men.
It is absolutely remarkable to see how that event really did change the world. And that man who tried to pull you off the race, Jock Semple, 5 years later, the story goes that he was instrumental in helping pave the way for women to officially be allowed to run, even though, as you said, women really were allowed to run. But what did he change? How did he have a change of heart?
Well, he wasn't, I would say, instrumental in getting women in the race.
Okay. See, this is why I wanted to get the clarity on the story.
When we did our legislative work and got the women officially into the race, he had to accept us. But then after he saw us and how well we ran, he then became quite an evangelist for women's running. That is true. It is interesting how people sometimes fight something for so long, and when they finally see the light, as it were, they completely change and become evangelists for the right thing.
I've heard you say over the years, and I just want you to briefly share the story with our listeners, that when you are back at the Boston Marathon now, you are besieged by people who hug you. People cry, don't they? I mean, it's really remarkable the reaction you get.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, those women who fall into my arms weeping, it's because running itself is a transformational experience. And that's why there are more women runners in the country now than men. It's because it is very, very empowering for women. It is simple, easy, cheap, accessible, and it really, really changes them into feeling full of self-esteem and confidence. And so it is amazing. And when I go to Boston and these women tell me the story of their lives and how running has changed them, you know, I find it very, very validating, because for so long I, you know, would talk about running and women themselves would think that I was, you know, kind of off with the fairies. But now, you know, now they're all on board. It's really, really amazing. To the point, Evan, where now, who would have imagined it? But that bib number, 261, that the official tried to throw off of me, has become this number meaning fearless in the face of adversity. And women everywhere are wearing this number and embracing this number. And I'm very proud to announce at this time, we have just harnessed this number into a movement called 261 Fearless. And we have filed for our 501c3 status. And this foundation is going to reach out to other women around the world, many of whom are fearful, with us who are fearless women, and helping them kind of through the vehicle of running get that same sense of empowerment and self-esteem. It's very, very powerful.
Wow. How are we going to be able to sort of follow the movement, the 261 movement?
Well, anybody on Facebook will see that it's everywhere, all over Facebook, but you can also go to www.261fearless.org. So we already have our first website up. We're working on a more elaborate one, but we can have people join, start a club, become an ambassador, and spread the word.
My guest for a few more minutes is Catherine Switzer, the first woman to run the Boston Marathon as a registered numbered runner in 1967 and a past inductee of the National Women's Hall of Fame in Seneca Falls. We're getting ready for the 2015 inductions. What did it mean to you to be inducted?
You know, it was such a huge honor. I guess there is no greater honor for a woman in the United States unless it's the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And so to be inducted into the Hall of Fame was phenomenally wonderful and exciting for me. It wasn't about crashing the Boston Marathon, but it was about for the work that followed afterwards and really using running as a social revolution to empower women's lives. So to be recognized for that was really, really wonderful. And I am in and see such heavy, heavy company. There are incredible women this weekend who are going to be getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. And more and more are they becoming role models and getting high visibility now, thanks to the National Women's Hall of Fame in Seneca Falls, for other women.
I brought up the story of Jock Semple again, maybe not getting all of the credit. We don't want to give him too much credit for what happened at the Boston Marathon in future years. But the man who tried to throw you off that course in 1967, as you say, did become an evangelist for women in running when he fully understood that he had been wrong. And to me, that's a sign that people can change, people can evolve. And here in 2015, you know, it wasn't that long ago, Catherine, we had a conversation about the movement last year online that I don't need feminism because, you know, we don't need feminism anymore. We've achieved everything we wanted to achieve. When you see those kinds of conversations, what stands out to you, you know, as ground that we haven't yet covered? What is in your mind that, you know, what comes to mind when you hear people say, well, we don't need feminism anymore?
Well, first of all, somebody much more famous than I said the price of freedom is constant vigilance. And you really have to remember your history or you're doomed to repeat it. And every woman in the world who is enjoying the freedom that she now has from the feminist movement, and it sounds like a pejorative term, but all feminism means is being equal. So it's not a pejorative term. And they should be passing this on to their daughters and sons and every kid they know out there. But let me just tell you that most of the women in the world, most, live in a fearful situation. We are very, very blessed in the United States and in other industrialized countries. There are millions of women who can't even go out of their house alone, get an education, drive a car, have faces covered. You know, it's unbelievable, and we really owe it to these women to change the world. Half the population is in this kind of situation. You know, we really owe it to our sisters and brothers, you know, to help the world be a better place.
I'll wrap with this, Catherine. You won the 1974 New York City Marathon. Your times that you have put up in marathons are absolutely amazing. And now in 2015, how much running do you do?
Hey, wait for this. Public announcement. I'm planning on running the Boston Marathon in 2017. It's going to be my 50th anniversary. We have a flotilla of women who are going to run under the banner of 261 Fearless. And so I'm going to be out there. Oh, yeah, I still run every day and still run marathons. I'm not going to run another marathon until 2017. And, you know, just to make sure. But we're going to be there. Yes, absolutely. Running has changed my life, and every day I run, it's the bonus.
Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time to join the program today. Again, congratulations on being a past inductee, and we will be watching to see what 261 Fearless is doing. It's really interesting to see that you know, you're still so active and doing all of these impressive things. Thanks for taking the time for the program.
Thanks, Evan, and congratulations to all the women who are getting inducted this year into the National Women's Hall of Fame.
It's Catherine Switzer, the first woman to run as a registered runner in the Boston Marathon. Deadspin, one of our listeners, Josh, online, sends me a link to deadspin.com. They did a big feature on this earlier this year, the behind the photo that changed the Boston Marathon forever. And in their montage, the quote is, "He was pulling at me and screaming, 'Get the hell out of my race and give me that number.'" Just amazing. just amazing. I mean, that's 48 years ago. That's not that long ago. It's not that long ago, and I was just having a conversation with a couple of the women in our office, including the great engineer of this program, Val LaBanca, about what are the things that we're going to look back on, you know, what's the next thing? I'm embarrassed about that photograph. I'm embarrassed for our country that people were running races thinking to women, get the hell out of my race. Women can't run. What are we going to look back at next? But I guess that's part of the ongoing discussion on what equality really means. So Judy, some final thoughts for our audience as we get ready to wrap the hour here.
Okay. One thing I want to mention is that Catherine has been fundamental in helping to co-sponsor a race that is going to be held in Seneca Falls in May of next year. It's going to be a 19K race, 19 because of the 19th Amendment. And so she continues to further the movement in lots of ways.
By the way, I'm doing math in my head, and I'm thinking that's basically a half marathon is what that is I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And some thoughts, Diana, what do you think?
Oh, I just I'm thinking about what Catherine Switzer said about having to remember history or we're doomed to repeat it. It really underscores the importance of the mission of the National Women's Hall of Fame. Executive Director and CEO Jill Teigen gives a lot of presentations talking about how women's stories are just not told. And, you know, less than 10% of the content of history is included in textbooks that our children learn from. The Hall is making sure that stories of significance like Catherine Switzer's or Lily Ledbetter's are being heard. And so I invite everyone to participate this weekend at the on October 3rd for the induction ceremony, or to visit the Hall and see the stories of more than 250 women who've been inducted. I guarantee you'll have an equal length book list after you've visited the National Women's Hall of Fame.
One of our listeners on Twitter said, take your daughter. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take my son. That's what I'm going to do.
Good.
To get tickets, one more time before we go, Judy, to get tickets to October 3rd, to the event on October 3rd, that's two Saturdays from now in Seneca Falls, to get tickets, how do you do it?
You can do it a number of ways. You can go to the website, womenofthehall.org, and you will be able to find out how to do it there. Or you can call 315-568-8060. Hope to see you there.
Thank you so much, Judy. And again, congratulations on your past induction and a great class this year. Nice to talk to you. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
And Diana, thank you so much. Great conversation today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this outstanding program that is helmed by a woman, Val LaBanca, who does a great job for us every day. Thanks, Val. Val's giving us a great thumbs up here. And thank you for listening to member-supported public radio. Every one of our hours is available as a podcast on wxxinews.org/connections, and you can share them there. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.